At this part of the program, we are going to have a presentation of the ADB-MBI issue paper that you've heard this morning, Achieving Skilled Mobility in ASEAN Challenges, Progress, and Opportunities. Let me call on Dimitrios G. Papadimitriou, Distinguished Senior Fellow and President Emeritus of Migration Policy Institute and President of Migration Policy Institute Europe to discuss the highlights of the issue paper. Dr. Papadimitriou, please.
Thank you very much, Darwin, and it is a pleasure to be here, a pleasure to be with so many of you who are friends and collaborators and fellow conspirators over many decades sometimes, and also in the presence of new friends in the delegations of the various member states of the ASEAN. I know that we're running a bit late, what I think that I would like to do is, on the assumption that you all have had a chance to look at the paper that the ADB and MPI teams have prepared for you, I'm going to focus on just a few things that I think will occupy us for most of the time today. And the title of the paper, in a sense, makes it very clear what the it is, what the subject is for the next 2 days, Achieving Skilled Mobility in the ASEAN Economic Community, Challenges, Opportunities, and Policy Implications. Now, you all know, otherwise you wouldn't be around this table, that this has been a long-term objective of the ASEAN nations, to be able to actually allow people who are professionals in any of the 10 member states of the ASEAN to be able to move and practice their profession in another country on an equal footing. This also happens to be the objective of any other grouping of states that are trying to organize themselves in order to create more value for the members of their societies, for their people, more value for individual countries that belong to a grouping of countries, and more value for the organization that they have created, more value for ASEAN. And this is really what is behind this entire effort, to really understand better, not just how these issues have evolved over time, but more importantly, what can we say about how much success that there has been? What are the points in which we have identified obstacles? And during the course of the conversation, we'll probably identify additional obstacles that we may not have thought of or fully fleshed out in the paper, and to see how we can move forward. And what does moving forward means? The real objective here is to create opportunities for each one of the member states of the ASEAN to continue to invest at a much higher level in building their human capital infrastructure. In other words, in educating and training more and more of their people. When that happens, more and more of their people will have an interest in moving across ASEAN. When that happens, we will have to make sure that when professionals move, they can practice their occupation on equal footing, thus creating more value for everyone who is involved in the process. So, what are some of the obstacles that we have identified? And they are really, in so many ways, for the people who are experts in mobility and migration, fairly obvious, and I suspect for the rest of us here are fairly obvious. There are three things that we have identified, broad categories of things, that are act as, in a sense, disincentives for movement. They're obstacles, they're barriers to movement. The first one is that recognizing qualifications may sound fairly simple, but it is anything but simple. It's extremely complex. It is a very technical area. It is an area in which others in other parts of the world that have already tried, and some of them made great progress, have done so through a combination of imagination, political will, and the ability to actually allow for certain differences to continue to exist, and yet for individuals to be able to practice their occupation. Also, progress in this area is very uneven. Different countries within ASEAN, or for that matter, any grouping of states, will actually have made different progress at a different pace than others. In other words, we're not going to move in unison as 10 states within ASEAN in the next year. Progress is going to be made a bit uneven. Certain countries will be able to move first, other countries will follow. It's going to be extremely uneven. And finally, this is an issue area in which countries and professionals and bodies that regulate professions and people, the public, is conflicted around. It's not an easy thing to say, you know, that we're going to allow, let's say, a Greek engineer, this way I don't have to use an example from us, to come to the Philippines and start building buildings as civil engineers. You know, there are certain things that have to be, in a sense, thought of and evolved in a fairly natural way with a lot of pushing and pulling. There are labor market tests, for instance, that every country on earth likes to place on the table before a professional can actually practice a profession in another country. There's the issue of immigration, kinds of issues. Employment visas are not the same thing like travel visas. There are different rules. There are different instincts and priorities behind how one country chooses to issue employment visas. There are all sorts of labor market restrictions in terms of who is able to access those labor markets. In some instances, you have as much as constitutional requirements that dictate that certain occupations be only open to nationals of a country. There is certainly legal frameworks, legislative acts that do the same thing. And those things cannot be overcome simply by saying that they will be overcome. They have to be overcome almost one occupation at a time by demonstrating the advantage to everyone of opening up certain of these professions in a sort of systematic, progressive way. There are also all sorts of other complex and opaque requirements that are very procedural and administrative. And there are even simpler obstacles. If you're going to go to another country, even if you have the right to access the labor market in another country, you will almost always be at a disadvantage because you will not have adequate labor market information. In order to find a job, you have to really understand how the labor market operates, how one gets a job in a foreign place. In the early stages, professionals who may move may not have access to networks of other professionals from their own country that will allow them to negotiate the new environment in which they move to. And sometimes we analysts think that hiring processes have somehow formal processes, or most hiring processes, tend to be quite informal. There isn't some sort of a general registry to which everyone goes and gets their job from. Employers talk to employees. They say, we know that we're going to be needing some more whatever, architects or whatever. And an awful lot of the hiring gets done informally through these kinds of networks and informal hiring practices. The third set of obstacles, and this is really a, you know, may very well be the most difficult set of obstacles, have to do with how professionals in one country see the opportunities relative to the challenges of moving. The biggest challenge to moving in every system is language. The ability to move and practice your education in a country that speaks a different language. There are ways to bypass that difficulty by identifying, of course, what is the language of the occupation. In many instances, the language is English. If that is the case, then the focus has to be more on making sure that people, as part of their training, take part of their training in English. But nonetheless, language becomes, in my view, the number one obstacle in individual decisions whether to go or to stay. But these are not the only obstacles. This is not the only obstacle. There are also, and here we've used a general term that probably is not the exact perfect term to use, there are all sorts of cultural issues. In other words, this includes religion, how a society is organized, and as part of a society, you understand certain things in a certain way, but when you change societies, you have to relearn how not just the workplace, but the society itself is organized at the destination country. And you have to be able to learn that very quickly in order for you to succeed. And the third of all of these obstacles of this nature is what we call a loss of status that is often associated with movement as an individual to another country. In other words, if a firm hires you, if a firm brings an Indonesian engineer, let's say, or an architect, to help it build buildings in Singapore, just as an example, it's one thing, because multinational, international firms have internal ladders and policies that are more likely than not to treat people with the same qualifications in a similar way, perhaps even the same way. But as an individual, I'm a dentist in Laos with a degree that's recognized, you know, in all the other nine ASEAN nations, and I decide to go and establish a dentistry practice in Malaysia. How easy is that? It's not easy. It's extremely difficult. So this is going to take time for us to resolve also. But as with all of these issues, the only way to move forward is by starting now to actually begin to systematically identify the obstacles and offer some ways to actually break through those obstacles and begin to remove them. This way, whenever a professional who can practice his or her profession across the region can actually do so and succeed. And that is extremely important in this process. So how do we do this? And I'll finish here because I know we're running a bit behind. This is a policy goal, which is to understand how to succeed, how to remove barriers, and to then find both the technical means, which is what these MRAs are about, but also the political means to actually make movement possible. You cannot have success if you're only making progress in one of these two very important ways. At the end of the day, politicians at the highest level will have to see clearly the advantages for their country, for their publics, to work it together to try to remove some of these obstacles. It will require a bit of risk taking, it will require patience, and it will require an awful lot of expertise on the part of professional bodies, on the part of individuals, on the part of the ASEAN framework agreements, of the ASEAN Secretariat. And incidentally, this is one of the things, you know, that this joint ADB-MPI project will try to do, to create, identify opportunities, and suggest ways to take advantage of these opportunities. This is the right time to do it. The ASEAN nations have agreed to these things, I guess back in 2005. It's a process that has already lasted 10 years. A lot of progress has been made, but not enough progress. So I think that we have to be fair about it. It is a timely policy goal. At the end of the day, if you want to compete, if you want to grow, particularly in today's world, you're going to have to think creatively and imaginatively as to how to actually build up your human capital infrastructure, what kind of educational and training reforms you have to make. You have to create more people who are prepared in a way that they can practice their profession everywhere. And you have to create real opportunities for them to move if they so wish. Because there is something about human capital in today's and tomorrow's world that perhaps we all know it, every single one of us here, but we seem to forget it sometimes when we talk or act, which is that human capital, if it's not already the ultimate resource, it is on its way to being or becoming an ultimate resource. It is at the very basis of competitiveness. Competitive firms make for more competitive nations, and in the case of the ASEAN, the more member states of the ASEAN are invested in the education and training of people, not only according to common ASEAN standards, but to international standards. Let me just, in a sense, end with a bit of a scary thought. As human capital is recognized around the world as something akin to the ultimate resource, people who have the skills and education and want to move, if they cannot move within the region, will move internationally, beyond the region. And I ask us all, is this what the ASEAN nations want to see? More and more of their better, best educated and trained individuals ending up in Canada, the United States, and every other place, because increasingly, everyone around the world is on this human resources or human capital gain. Makes no difference whether you're a little Belgium, large Germany, very large United States, or for that matter, China. They all are going after the same people. In order for you to be able to keep more of the people that you educate and train, you're going to have to make it much easier for those people to move within the region. And if that is the case, and if opportunities abound, and if the region takes off even more economically, more people will actually stay. And I think ultimately, in terms of the vision, this may very well be what it is that we all need to aim toward. Building up our educated and trained people, because that's how firms decide where to locate, where to expand production facilities. That's how you build and grow a middle class, which then grows a consumer class, which makes it then even more important for firms to come and locate in your country. The world in the years ahead is going to be a very ugly, competitive world. I think the ASEAN community, economic community, needs to begin to take steps today in order to be successful tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dimitri. And clearly, these are the questions that we'll be asking for the rest of the day, today and tomorrow, and hopefully finding some answers. Now, let me call on Rana Hassan, Director of the Development Economics and Indicators Division of the Economics Research and Regional Cooperation Department of the ADB to provide perspectives from the institutional for ADB. Rana, please.
Thank you all very much. I'm really honored to be here and very pleased that all of you are here as well. In terms of my remarks, I thought that I'd provide a little bit of perspective from some work that we are doing on the issue of skills, qualification frameworks, etc. And my presentation here, I try to be brief. It's perhaps taking a bit of a step back and looking at some of the things that we are learning about the issue of education, skills, technological change, and really I think these things have pretty important implications for the kind of activities that we are focusing on in this particular project. So I'd like to focus on, I'll touch upon three things. One has to do about the issue of the quantity versus quality of education, because I think at heart a number of the puzzles, so to speak, you know, when you start looking at the data, when you start talking to workers, firms, a part of what's going on is this this thing about quantity versus quality of education. So I'll speak a bit about that. Second, terminology. I think terminology is extremely important. Dimitri had made this point when we met 2-3 months ago. You know, terminology in that context, we were talking about the issue of migration and mobility, and sometimes these are very loaded terms. But we also see that in terms of when we're talking about education and skills. Finally, I'll just end with something about the role of the firm. Again, something that came up the last time we met. Very, very simple chart over here. This is a plot on years of education in the region. And what we find is, when you look at the region back in, say, 1970, when you compare today, you see a phenomenal increase in the years of education. On average, our region, and now I'm talking broadly about the Asia region, had about, people on average had about 4 years of education. Today, that's double. You're seeing about 8 years of education. Now, how does that translate into growth? This is a scatter plot. It's just taking a global sample and it's looking at how growth is related to education. And here, we're just simply talking about years of education, and you see that, in fact, there's a, it's not a super watertight relationship, but it's clearly the more educated people you are, the more you grow. But when you start parsing this relationship and digging a bit deeper, you find some interesting things. The panel on the left, what that demonstrates, what the panel on the left does is it takes that education variable and it breaks it down into the component of education that's really capturing skills. And skills here is basically a measure of cognitive skills. It's what your 15-year-olds understand about science and mathematics based on the international PISA tests. The panel on the right-hand side is just looking at the pure years of education effect. And the story that comes out is very interesting.
what it's telling us is that the education growth relationship is really driven by measurable skills. So countries which have been able to ensure that their educational systems are actually developing cognitive skills, skills more generally, are the ones where you've got this education growth relationship. For countries which have not paid attention to quality, which have not paid attention to the types of skills that, you know, whether it's students, whether it's trainees in TVET are learning, you're not going to see that done. Number two, terminology. All too often, we use these terms education and skills very interchangeably, and then we have all these puzzles about, you know, when you go to workers in factories and ask them, do you think you are well matched in terms of qualifications? Do you think you're underqualified? Do you think you're overqualified? Turns out that a lot of workers feel that they are overqualified. You have people who have college degrees who are driving taxis. You have college degree holders doing jobs that you think could be done with less education. So in the background is a bit of this issue of terminology. We think that the research that we are doing, the research that's actually been popularized in the labor literature in the US, especially the literature that's been trying to figure out the effects of technology on labor markets, has introduced this task framework. So the idea here is that firms basically want workers to carry out tasks. These tasks are of different types. Some require physical manual work, some require problem-solving skills. Some are repetitive. Not all manual work is repetitive. Think about the work that a domestic employee does, a cleaner does, a hairdresser does. It's not repetitive at all. On the other hand, you have some skilled work, which is very repetitive. The work of some types of accounting are becoming repetitive. Why that matters is because anything that's repetitive, anything that's routinizable, can be taken over by a computer or automated. So the old way of thinking about education and skills in terms of, you know, highly educated, less educated, is not so useful in today's work. And precisely because of the way technology is coming in and taking over some types of tasks. So it's useful to use this terminology in terms of tasks, and then workers bring skills. So the firm wants certain tasks done, workers bring certain skills, and their skills determine how proficiently or how much efficiency they can carry out those tasks. Now, education is a very important way to acquire those skills, but by no means is it the only one. Next slide, please. This is just telling us, if we look at the different types of skills, we can think of them in terms of basically the rudimentary skills that you learn, the foundational skills, the ability to interpret data, the non-cognitive skills, being able to work in teams. Increasingly, when you talk to firms, they're saying that, look, the soft skills, the interpersonal skills, the ability to work in teams is something that we're lacking. And then, of course, you have these vocational technical skills. These skills allow you to carry out the tasks, as I mentioned. But at the bottom, you see that it's not only general education, it's not only vocational technical education. Families matter for learning important skills, especially non-cognitive skills, being able to get along with others, etc. Things that sometimes families impart. But what's also very important is the firm. So in the one country where the data sets are probably the best, which is the United States, which has a very long set of panel data on workers, tracking them over time, testing them, tracking them as they move in and out of jobs, you find that actually 20 to 60% of the total skills that a person acquires in their lifetime are being acquired in the firm. And what that tells you is that the type of firm your economy has is actually an extremely important determinant of what you're going to be able to do with your human resources. Countries which put in investment climates which are hostile to modern formal sector firms coming up are going to be countries which are actually going to impede their ability to make headway on their skills agendas. Next slide. as I mentioned earlier, why do these terminologies matter? And here's some data to back up what I was saying. The overqualified is the red bar, and across these different countries, you've got these surveys were carried out in Armenia, in Yunnan province of China, in Georgia, Laos, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, and you find this red bar very high, this perception that workers have of being overqualified. We can skip this slide. Now coming to an issue that's extremely important for this project. One of the things we did is, that we're doing, and we're going to be releasing the report on October 20th, is we said, okay, let's move away from perception-based data and let's look at some hard data on the actual work that people are doing, the occupations, and then based on detailed firm surveys that the ILO has carried out, we know, we have a reasonably good sense of what kind of education is required to perform those different tasks. And on the basis of that, we were able to look at this issue of overqualification and underqualification. And what we see in the region is, and this has implications for growth prospects, is that there are a lot of occupations where you have a lot of people working without the right education. So in a sense, this is a problem of underqualification. So while many workers may feel that they're overqualified, that they actually have the right degrees, etc., when we look at some of the data from enterprises and labor force surveys, we're actually seeing the opposite. And managers is one of those occupations where there seems to be an underappreciation of how higher education and how high-level training can actually help. Next slide. And this is where I just come to the last slide about the issue of firms. I've already talked about firms being very important in this. You can just go to the next. And now, the issue of firms is very interesting. Part of the research that we're doing is showing the role of how the firm is managed and the issue of human resource management in particular. And as I went through the issues paper that Dimitri and other colleagues from the MPI and Guntur put together, I was struck by the issue of the firms, about the perceptions at the firm level, the lack of knowledge at the level of the firm. And it dovetails very nicely with some of this recent literature on the management of firms. These are surveys that have been carried out by the LSE, Stanford, and other agencies. At the ADB, we also funded part of these surveys in India and China. And what we find from these surveys is that firms in Asia, the best firms in Asia are extremely well managed. They tend to be as well managed as the best OECD firms. The problem in Asia is that we have a very long tail of mismanaged or weakly managed firms. There are standard best practices out there on how you deal with logistics, quality control, and human resource management. And a lot of the firms in the region are doing quite weakly on this. This last slide is just meant to show you a factory floor. It's a photograph from a factory floor in the United States. The study that we're going to be bringing out talks about this in more detail, and we are working on these issues. But I just wanted to highlight two aspects about these photographs. One is just the way you lay out, the way you organize the work floor is extremely complex, and with the introduction of computers and automation, this is an even more challenging task. Our ability to use computers and the information that they provide is really a tip of the iceberg. I think over the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to be seeing a lot of change taking place in how the workplace is organized. And that what that's going to require is not only very well-trained managers and people who think scientifically about human resource management, it's also going to require very well-trained workers. And a very simple illustration of this is this whiteboard. Increasingly, you know, when you go to different factories, and it doesn't have to be just manufacturing, it's even services, you see information. The information metrics is extremely important. Just conveying information to teams, to workers, is important. when you have workers who don't really understand how to grasp that information, it is a problem. So with that, let me end here, and I think we'll have more opportunity as the 2 days proceed in being able to see how some of these concepts, which are lying in the background of a lot of the discussion on skills, can actually fits in quite nicely to the agenda that we have over here. Thank you very much.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.